This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. State lawmakers have packed up and gone home to their districts after passing a $22 billion spending plan for the next fiscal year. And more than half of that budget supports K through 12 education spending. This year's plan includes teacher raises and a significant expansion of the school voucher program. Lawmakers also passed a bill that allows the state to take over 5 low-performing schools and turn them over to charter management organizations. Jess Clark is here to talk about the education policies that were passed in this year's short session. She's WUNC's Fletcher Fellow for Education Policy Reporting. Hello, Jess.
Hi.
Let's talk about those raises first. That's what got most of the attention. How big are the teacher raises and who's getting them?
Right. So lawmakers are saying there's an average 4.7% increase in teacher salaries. That's not super helpful if you're an individual teacher, because that's kind of the average. So those raises range from about 2% for beginning and teachers with the most experience, right, up to 8% for teachers with kind of the middle range of experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. The focus was on those mid-career teachers, not at the far end, the most experienced, and not at the incoming, the new teachers, right?
Right. And the rationale for that is that last year, beginning teachers got that significant pay raise, bumping them from $33,000 a year to $35,000 a year. This year, lawmakers are saying we already focused on beginning teachers. Now we want to focus on retaining mid-career teachers.
Now, we might think that when you're talking about teacher raises, that's education spending. Certainly, it is part of the education budget. But overall and over time, let's take a look at how education spending for the entire education budget, how does that fit the picture?
So this year, lawmakers did increase the overall education spending by about 3% over last year. But we did see an enrollment increase, and of course there is inflation, so probably per pupil you're not going to see more than like 1 or 2% increase in per pupil spending. So when you're talking about education spending, you're mostly talking about salaries, because education is a very human, it really relies on human capital. Like, you know, 80% of the budget goes to personnel salaries.
Right.
So teacher salary is important. This bumps us from looking at legislative changes in other states. This budget should bump us from 9th in the Southeast to 7th, and it should get us to an average around $50,000 a year.
But that per pupil spending and what gets cut and what remains in the budget is an important thing for teachers. They certainly look at their salary, but they also look at their classroom experience. So if you're cutting teacher aides, if you don't have supplies and all that, that is something that a teacher might take into account in deciding where they want to teach or what state they'd like to go to.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have in the recession in 2010, lawmakers cut spending for most significantly for textbooks and classroom resources. And since then, we have kind of ticked back up. We're still not to where we were. We're still not funding textbooks and classroom resources where we were before the recession.
Been a large expansion of the voucher program. How large is that program now, and how big do lawmakers want to make it get?
Well, right now, lawmakers have been increasing the funding for that program each year. It started in 2014. They set aside $10.8 million. Last year, it was $17.6 million. This year, it was expected to go to $24.8 million. And instead of funding it at $24.8 million, they actually put $34 million in a reserve fund. So that is meant to kind of solidify the existence of this program for future years. So that money in that reserve can only be used for opportunity scholarships or school vouchers. These are scholarships of around, I think the maximum is $4,200 for low-income families.
Let me stop you right there, because I want,
sure,
do want to make a distinction between vouchers and charter schools. And so tell us how a voucher would work.
Right. So vouchers... Vouchers is it's basically a scholarship or a grant that an individual family applies for. They say, you know, I'm below this income. I want to send my kid to a private school rather than a public school. And so the state checks their income and says, okay, you qualify. Here is $4,200 to spend on the private education of your choice. That's different from a charter school. Charter schools are public schools, and those spots are funded basically at the same, almost the same rate as per pupil spending in the district where that student.
And this is interesting because there are critics, particularly among conservatives and Republicans, who will say that our public education program, our public education is broken, that we need more accountability. We should turn it over to the private sector. And so, but what's interesting about this is to be clear, it is public money. So all of our money is still going from the public into these private schools. So that part, the part of the fact that we're still paying through our tax dollars, is still true. It's just now going into private pockets.
Right. It is going into private schools. And I think, you know, this has already been litigated at the state Supreme Court. So, you know, 93% of voucher dollars are going to religious schools. That rubs a lot of people the wrong way. But the state Supreme Court came down and said this is legal. So I think now what opponents of this program are looking at is the fact that, you know, we hold our public schools to a very high standard of accountability. We have the A through F school grading system, et cetera. Private schools have hardly, I mean, relative to public schools, have hardly any accountability measures. They are required to test their students each year that are receiving vouchers on nationally normed tests. But that can be any nationally normed test. And some of these tests are, you know, we don't know what they are.
So it's important to point out that public money would be going into institutions with less accountability. That brings us to charter schools. There's been a change in that. So now five schools would be turned over to charter programs.
Right. So this bill would take five of the lowest performing elementary schools in the state and take them out of their local school districts and turn them over to charter management organizations. So these organizations can be a nonprofit like a KIPP, but they can also be a for-profit school like American Heritage Academies, for example. Basically, the state takes them out, puts them under the management of these organizations, and has a superintendent that oversees all of the schools. There's a lot of pushback against this legislation. One, because a lot of people have problems with the state taking away local control of their schools. A lot of these schools are going to be in low-income communities, probably communities of color. So there's a lot of friction there.
Obviously, less accountability as you go up the chain. The farther and farther you get from your locality, the less pressure that you can put on as a parent. So there's less accountability there.
Well, I mean, you could argue that. I think that Republicans would probably argue against that and say there's more accountability because you're not beholden to this to DPI and the bureaucratic structures there. So you know, it kind of goes either way.
It does go back and forth on accountability. If you look at vouchers, less accountability at the local level, more accountability to certain states. It's a very confusing picture. So what about these charter schools? We said five. Have they been identified? And if not, how will they?
They have not been identified. What will happen is once the superintendent who's going to oversee that, if the district that those schools will form, will select those five schools. And those five schools do not have to, their school district does not have to agree to let those schools go. They can take them out. And that is probably what got the most pushback where this has been tried in other states. Most notably, it was tried in Nashville and Memphis. And huge community pushback there. The management companies fired pretty much all of the staff, the principals, and you know, there was a lot of and as well as in New Orleans this happened too, and it pretty much decimated the Black middle class because that's where a lot of the Black middle class was employed in those areas.
Any research on how effective this is?
Yes, there is research from Vanderbilt University, they looked at the 3 years of the program in Nashville and Memphis, and after 3 years, students in the schools that were run by the charter management organizations had performed no better on state tests than students in other low-performing schools that were still managed by the local school district. So we don't see... research does not show that this has an effect on student achievement. In fact, it shows that after the first year of this being implemented, student achievement plummeted and has since risen back up to where it was over the last 2 years.
Finally, lawmakers also put tuition caps on some schools in the UNC system. Tell us about that.
So there's two kind of tuition provisions in the budget. One of them would cap tuition at three small North Carolina institutions. One of those is Western Carolina University. The other is Elizabeth City State University, and the other one is UNC Pembroke. So tuition for those schools for in-state students is capped at $500 a semester. For out-of-states, it's $2,500 a semester. And right now, the leadership of those schools is on board. Their enrollment has been declining. They see this as a way to stabilize it, and the state has set aside like $40 million in order to cover the gap between the new tuition rate and what they would have charged. But there is pushback from this, right? Because it makes, the legislature has put aside this funding to keep them afloat this year. But if that tuition is capped and they have no way to raise their own funds, that makes them beholden to the legislature in future years. So there is some pushback there.
Jess, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jess Clark is WUNC's Fletcher Fellow for Education Policy Reporting. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about education spending and policy in the state. In the most recent round of budget negotiations, the governor prioritized teacher pay raises and more funding for digital education. But opponents of the governor's plan say North Carolina's relatively low spending per pupil indicates that those priorities are misguided. They say more funding should be restored to local school districts to pay for basic needs like textbooks and more support staff. Here to talk about the state's education policy is Catherine Truitt. She is senior education advisor to Governor McCrory. Catherine, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us is Mark Jewell. He's president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, a teachers union with chapters across the country. Mark, welcome to the State of Things.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Catherine, good to have you. Catherine, let me start with you. Teacher pay and digital learning were the top priorities for the governor this year. Why?
Well, Frank, I think that there's definitely no doubt that we need to continue building on the commitment that the governor made when he entered office to continue to build teacher pay. We are now, North Carolina is increasing faster than any other state in the nation for teacher pay. Digital learning is the future of our public schools. And we have to continue to modernize classrooms to allow teachers to harness the power of digital learning software and technology in order to meet the needs of all students.
Mark, how do you think the state should have directed its funding and set priorities this year?
Well, obviously, and may I say hi to my friend Catherine out there? We
hi,
run in
Mark.
Some of the same circles. Good to be with you.
Clearly,
we are pleased that the state is hearing the cry of teacher salaries out there. Though we do feel it's still shortchanging our public school teachers out there, particularly those with the most experience. We're seeing getting a less of the percentage of the increase out there. As many of you know, we have a huge teacher shortage crisis in North Carolina. Probably a couple of thousand positions remained vacant the entire year, including in the elementary, which we used to have a surplus not too long ago. We have science and math positions that actually remained, have substitutes in them for the past 3 years. So we know this is a chronic crisis. We hope that a more strategic plan will be put forward in the next coming years to address teacher pay and per pupil funding. That's a big issue with our communities out there. We know that they have contributed a little extra money, about $10 million to textbooks this year and to the digital learning. However, we are concerned that more could be given when the state is sitting on $1 billion a surplus right now. The addition of $35 million to school vouchers this year actually can be funneled into textbook resources. I'm very concerned that, and the textbook is still, funding is still below what we were prior to the recession. Now, though we do know that many schools are going digitally on textbooks, we also know that hard copies are very, very important for home resources to be used. And, you know, parents need something to really help their kids with. So it's a problem out there that we're not committing more resources into the classroom and having a strategic plan to increase teacher pay.
Well, let's take those one of the. Let's talk about the strategic plan, Catherine. Does the governor have a strategic plan? The idea, it does seem that we're living kind of year to year for teacher pay. And so if you're looking from the outside, if you're coming, deciding where you want to go as a teacher, you can't see 5 years out what the state of North Carolina plans to do. Is that something the governor should take a lead on?
Well, I think that the strategic plan is to keep increasing teacher pay. What I would argue is that we have been digging out of a hole since the governor entered office. Teacher pay dropped considerably in the 12 years under Democratic governors before he entered office. And we are, as I said, trying to dig out of that hole. So it's important, addressing Mark's point, fair point, about the shortage. Part of that, I would say, is related to teacher pay. And so we have to continue moving up in the ranks as we are. I would also point out that 84% of our teachers in North Carolina have less than 25 years experience. So if we want to continue to move up in the rankings, we have to target those increases, first of all, to that group that has 0 to 24 years experience. But also we know from data that teachers are leaving around year 14, which is where that 8% pay raise is targeted mostly.
Mark, Catherine says the Republicans and the governor are doing the best they can to dig out of a hole that was left them by 12 years of Democratic reign, and they're doing the best they can and, incrementally making progress.
Sure. And I think, that was a national recession that we were looking at in 2008 to 2009, where we had a $2 billion gap. Where we would have been decimated had the federal government not intervened. We'd have lost about 10,000 positions. But I think comparing that to a surplus now of $1 billion when we have had moderate growth, the rainy day fund in North Carolina is really raining right now in public education in North Carolina. It is not a teacher estimate.
Let's just go ahead and finish the thought, Mark, and then I'll go right back to you, Catherine.
Right. I was just going to say that it's storming right now in North Carolina, and I am very concerned when we have probably 20% of our teachers that are going to set to retire in the next couple of years, and we have a 30% decrease in our university teacher prep programs. So we are seeing actually right now teachers relocating to Virginia and South Carolina and not even having to move but can jump over and get $10,000 increases. One of the matters is because they get paid for their master's degree. We would like to see that reinvestment in professional development put into our college and university system. So I think, teacher pay is definitely part of it, but a lot of it is resources, class size, and, addressing our equity gaps of our students and poverty.
Catherine?
So what I would say is that the surplus ensures that states will have money on the downturn, so we won't have to furlough like Governor Perdue did. In addition to us falling in the ranks, which I would point out began before Governor Perdue, before the recession, when Governor Hunt left office, we ranked number 20. And by the time she took office, I believe we had fallen to 32. But I would also point out that because we did not have a rainy day fund, when we had the recession, she slashed the textbook fund from $111 million to $2.5 million. And since entering office, Governor McCrory has tripled that figure to $71.5 million. So again, another hole that we are digging out of. But I want to address the other point that Mark made, which is about attrition. When you look at the data for attrition, what we see is that only 1% of our teachers are leaving to teach in other states. So 1% of 96,000 teachers are leaving to teach in other states. The numbers that get reported on attrition are often inaccurate. And I want to make sure that listeners understand that we are not losing teachers in other states.
Let me ask you another question about this, too, because you talked about most of those cuts happened in because of the recession, as you pointed out. Since then, business has recovered. In fact, it's gone well beyond those where we were before the recession. And yet the legislature has cut taxes for corporations and cut taxes for the wealthy. The governor signed those tax cuts. Why not leave taxes where they were so that if you're really trying to dig out, you can actually have some funds to work with, apart from just the rainy day fund?
Catherine? Well, I think that what I would point to is that we have increased education spending by 18%. per pupil expenditure has been climbing up, and we have increased teacher pay faster than any other state. All of this while the governor has lowered unemployment in all 100 counties. It's at an 8-year low right now. We have the fastest growing economy in the country. Nearly 300,000 jobs have been created, and we have the most improved tax climate in the country. And I think that that is a considerable amount to brag about after just being in office for 3.5 years.
Mark, what about
the tax cuts spurred growth?
There's progress, and we're just going to have to be patient and wait for these things to kind of come along. And in fact, the state of North Carolina has made some pretty fast progress relative to other states.
I'm glad you brought up the point about the tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations, because when we have dropped almost a 7% to 6% to close to 5%, and other cuts coming forward, we see it that it is very problematic that although there is the education budget has increased, we've also had 35,000 students since 2012-2013. So when you calculate those extra 35,000 students, and may I say many of them are coming from impoverished homes and going into oversized classrooms with less teacher assistance and less human capital. And I will go back to the data and talk about the teacher turnover is around 14% in North Carolina. We cannot recruit nationally anymore. Any principal will tell you that. So what they're having to do is rob Peter to pay Paul. We have Charlotte Mecklenburg going to Kannapolis. We have a war going on between Guilford and Forsyth County about teacher pay, as well as in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Wake County. So I am very concerned about our impoverished areas where we have had, they can't get a certified teacher in the elementary schools anymore. We eliminated a very successful program called the Teaching Fellows, which actually grew our own and paid for the college tuition if they would go back to their home district and teach for 4 years. And most of them stayed well beyond that.
Catherine, another part of the budget. Well, go ahead. You can respond to that.
I just have to push back against part of that. Well, Mark said the attrition figure that he said, 14%, that includes retirees and people who switch counties but stay in North Carolina, as well as teachers who have been dismissed. So the real number of teachers who leave the profession is 6.8%.
And some of them also leave. They may not go to another state. They may decide that it's just not worth it for them to teach anymore, so they get out of the business whether they move or
Correct.
Not.
But it's 6.8%, not 14%.
But I do think we have to think of retirement, though, when teachers would stay in the profession had
Absolutely.
They been getting increases at the top of their pay.
I want to subjects a little bit and move on to the voucher program and charter schools, because another part of the budget talks about the state's voucher program, $34 million set aside for that. Catherine, where do you stand on that decision? Why do we want to put more money into vouchers?
Well, I've heard the governor say many times publicly that he believes parents are the best people to make the choice for what's right for their child. Oftentimes, families who are taking advantage of this have needs, maybe special needs that are not recognized on paper, so they want a smaller class size for their child. But also, we've got over 1,000 kids on a waiting list who have special needs who want to take advantage of these scholarships so that they can go to the school that is right for them. And I would point out that these dollars are state appropriated. This is not money that is leaving public schools and following the child. This is appropriated by the state.
It's appropriated, but it can go to a private school, can it?
Right.
So it does leave the public school system and goes into. I just want to clarify that. I want to make it clear that the voucher money can go anywhere, including a private school, which, and may I ask you this, has less accountability because they don't operate under the same rules as the public school system. I mean, isn't that part true?
Well, what I'm saying is that unlike a charter school, when a child receives the money for the opportunity scholarship, that the money that they would be spent on them in their public school stays in the public school, does not follow them.
Mark, what about that voucher program? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm sure you're aware, in North Carolina Association of Educators sued the state. We won in the lower courts. We lost the state Supreme Court, which was based on party line vote, might I add. And I think it is tragic that we are using public dollars to go to private schools that are basically unaccountable, where you don't even have to have a high school diploma to teach, and where 93% of those are faith-based And we don't know what the curriculum even looks like. Some are not even teaching best practices in research-based science curriculum. So I think
let me lose that argument anytime. Well, the accountability question is one I want to ask you, Catherine, because mm-hmm. there is, and again, this is money that may be appropriated extra beyond what is spent on education, but the argument could be made, well, if you have that money, then why not put that into the public schools where there is this extra accountability? What about the lack of accountability in private schools, Catherine?
Well, I think that a lot of parents choose to send their children to private schools. I choose to send my children to public schools, but I think parents should have the right to choose whether or not they want to send their child to a private school. And oftentimes, these parents are parents who, as your education reporter pointed out, fall below a certain income level and would not be able to afford the benefits that private schools give lots of kids.
Mark, you and your association have pointed out that you support Medicaid expansion and say that Absolutely. The failure of this state to do that has really hurt education. How so?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we have 500,000 children in poverty in North Carolina. Half of those are in extreme poverty. By the state of North Carolina refusing to fill in the gap of Medicaid, which is, of course, those who don't fall in the income and those who can't afford to buy health insurance. When kids come to school sick and unhealthy, it's impossible for them to be able to learn appropriately. And this is, we're basically paying for other states such as Kentucky to compensate the health care of their children there. So I think it's really sad that the fact that we're having children who could get sick and in some instances that they are passing away and their parents are dying because they can't have health care.
What about that, Catherine? Should we take a broader view of public education to include the medical needs of students?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on Medicaid, but my understanding of this federal program is that it already provides funding for children, and the federal expansion doesn't provide additional funding for children. The governor has been focused on improving mental and physical health through a Safer Schools program. And this is one of those instances where we allow locals to take the lead on these issues and try and partner with them as we can. If there are issues that are not being adequately funded at the local level, we can look and see what the state can do to assist. But, you know, there's lots of great public-private partnerships out there, some of which the General Assembly funds. There's an amazing program called Communities and Schools. 60% of their funding comes from our general fund. They push into schools, provide medical care, glasses, warm coats, food. Every school that I've ever visited has a backpack buddy program where they send food home on weekends with children. So there are
programs out there, but I guess the question is why turn away tens of billions of dollars in federal money that can help support parents who are critical to the educational needs of their children?
I'm sorry, could you say that
Why
again?
Turn away tens of billions of dollars and leave a 500,000 people without coverage when you could have added to the list of programs that you just named the support for those parents and their medical needs?
Right now,
expand Medicaid did that.
Yeah, right now our DHHS department is working on an innovative solution that is specific to North Carolina, and I'm sure that they would be glad to come on and talk to you about it.
Mark, North Carolina Association of Educators has called for HB2 to be repealed. Why?
Sure. We think it's dangerous and it hurts children and it turns back decades of civil rights progress that we've had in North Carolina. The value of diversity for all of our children has always been one of our core values. And we think that this stigmatizes a group of children that are already vulnerable to bullying and harassment. And quite frankly, the rhetoric that's been coming out of the majority administration of our population, the governor's office, has been very heartbreaking for the community and the children that we serve.
Catherine, how do you think HB2 is affecting our schools?
Well, you know, when I travel around the schools, I talk to principals and superintendents about this issue. They tell me that they have been accommodating transgender students for some time now without controversy. I know that they certainly feel insulted that the federal government has reached out to them to say you must accommodate students, these transgender students, when they have been doing it already. They've been handling it appropriately and with compassion. And I would say that right now this is in the hands of the court. The ruling will come down when it comes down, and when it does, we will follow the law in North Carolina.
All right. Catherine Truitt, Governor McCrory's education advisor. Mark Jewell is the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators. Mark, were you about to say something?
Yes, I was just going to add on that many of our schools, or particularly in some of our large urban areas, did have protections for gender identity for our students in their school districts. And having this piece of legislation be enacted pretty much wiped out some of the policies that they were doing. So it is our job to make sure we protect all teachers' rights, particularly those that are most vulnerable and those in minority statuses there. So, you know, I think, you know, waiting on federal legislation is that we could risk losing a generation of students.
Mark Jewell, the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Catherine Truitt, Governor McCrory's education advisor. Good to talk with you, Catherine.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Just ahead, a Duke professor challenges the myth of a post-racial society. Stay tuned.